It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday News. Thank you for listening to KMXT. On 100.1 FM, it's your public radio station. We're broadcasting from Signal Hill in Kodiak, Alaska, where it's 31 degrees right now under mostly cloudy skies. We're looking for a high near 37 today. West winds should turn to the south this afternoon, only about 10 miles per hour. For tonight, rain mainly after 9, could be heavy at times, low of about 33 tonight. Rain and snow on tap for tomorrow, mainly before noon. Coming up on the Midday News, a recap of the first day of the Scandies Rose hearing. A remembrance of Katie Hurley Institution. UAF Cooperative Extension Service Agricultural Agent talks about farming in Alaska. After NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Golf star Tiger Woods has been in a major car crash in Southern California. NPR's Tom Goldman has the latest.
According to Tiger Woods' longtime agent, Mark Steinberg, Woods was in surgery after suffering multiple leg injuries in the accident. "We thank you for your privacy and support," Steinberg said in a statement to Golf Digest. According to the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department, the single vehicle rollover collision happened early this morning. Woods was removed from the wreck using the jaws of life. After exploding on the professional golf world in 1900 scandal and numerous medical procedures for golf-related injuries, he recently had his fifth back surgery and has been rehabbing in hopes of playing this year's Masters in April. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
Former U.S. Capitol Security officials say they did not have sufficient information ahead of January 6th to accurately predict the scale of the insurrection on the U.S. Capitol. NPR's Barbara Sprint has more from today's joint hearing, the first of many to investigate the security failures.
One theme dominated the hearing, former security officials saying they didn't get adequate information from the intelligence community. Former Capitol Police Chief Stephen Sun said he based his planning for January 6 on intelligence that the demonstrations were expected to be similar in nature to previous Make America Great Again rallies.
None of the intelligence we received predicted what actually occurred.
On the eve of the attack, the FBI sent a report detailing various calls for violence the next day, but Sun says the warning never reached him. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News.
Recovery and a political reckoning are underway in Texas over the response to an unprecedented winter crisis that left millions of people without electricity or water for days. After Senator Ted Cruz came under fire for leaving the state when his constituents most needed help, the state's attorney general is also facing backlash. Texas Public Radio's Lauren Tejasas has details.
Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton traveled to Utah for a previously planned meeting with that state's AG, Sean Reyes. They discussed several matters, including their multi-state antitrust lawsuit against Google. Paxton's wife, Texas State Senator Angela Paxton, was also in Utah for meetings related to her efforts to support law enforcement, according to a spokesperson from her office. Several Texas Democrats criticized the Paxton's travel, including the Texas House Democratic Caucus Chair, Chris Turner, who questioned why a virtual meeting was not arranged instead. For NPR News, I'm Lauren Terrazas in San Antonio.
Iran's begun restricting international inspections of its nuclear facilities as it pressures the U.S. and other countries to lift all sanctions. The Biden administration and others are calling it a dangerous move, further jeopardizing revival of a 2015 nuclear accord. This is NPR.
NPR News is brought to you in part by Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. For an appointment or more information, 481-2400.
Yesterday, the Coast Guard Marine Board of Investigation finished up day one of their hearings about the Scandies Rose sinking. After presenting a rundown of facts about the fishing vessel Scandies Rose, they also presented a Mayday call and a side scan imaging of the final resting place of the 130-foot crab boat followed by a moment of silence. The Scandi's Rose sank just south of Sutwick Island on New Year's Eve of 2019, around 10 p.m. 5 of the 7 crew were lost. 3 people testified yesterday. Dan Mattson, owner of the Scandi's Rose, was questioned on the ownership and corporate structure, the state of repair of the vessel, maintenance, and his relevant experience as a longtime fisherman, particularly while fishing nearby this night of the tragedy. These questions focused on the history of maintenance and repair on the Scandi's Rose and the reports of relevant inspections, which seemed to indicate that the Scandi's Rose was in good condition. One inspector noted that the boat was among the best of the West Coast-built fishing boats. One document presented during Mattson's testimony showed that the crew had undergone emergency safety drills mere hours before the boat sank. Mattson was followed by Jalila Cooper, operations manager for the Scandi's Rose, who answered questions about crew drug testing. One survivor tested positive for marijuana after being rescued, and drug test reporting by the captain was inconsistent. Mattson also addressed the boat's repair history after the 2017 sinking of the FV Destination. John Walsh, a minority owner and insurance broker for the vessel, answered questions about the Scandi's stability report and how other factors such as a captain's health could figure into liability insurance. After major repairs in 2019, the boat was valued at over $3 million. Walsh said, quote, "That is the last boat I thought would ever sink," end quote. Day 2 of the hearings will feature testimony from the National Weather Service and for people who have conducted repairs on the Scandi's. Those hearings continue today, beginning with the testimony from Noelle Runyon of the National Weather Service in Anchorage. She was asked about how a weather phenomenon like freezing spray, how it's forecast, and how her office took feedback from mariners, and on weather during the night of the sinking. She stated that the weather was typical of a strong storm. The Scandi's Rose sank on New Year's Eve around 10 p.m. Ed Erler of Loverick's Seacraft also provided testimony. He had done dry dock work on the FV Scandi's Rose. He was asked questions on maintenance and repairs the vessel had been through, as well as the condition of the vessel, which he described as, quote, "better than most," end quote. The hearing was then called on Erling Jacobson, a marine surveyor. He was asked what he made of the crew and the vessel's condition. He said the condition of the Scandi's Rose was excellent. He also said he thought highly of the Scandi's Rose's captain, Gary Cobbin. He is to be questioned further after lunch recess today. For continuing coverage, visit kmxt.org. President Biden's pick for Interior Secretary is appearing before the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee this morning, and Alaska Native leaders strongly support her. Deb Haaland was one of the first 2 Indigenous women elected in the U.S. House and would be the first Native person to lead the Interior Department. Haaland is a member of the Pueblo of Laguna. Former state legislator Mary Petella of Bethel says Haaland's background matters because the Interior Secretary has enormous sway over issues like subsistence hunting and fishing rights, tribal courts, and Native allotments.
For hundreds of years, we really haven't had many Native people at the top who have a true understanding of the way that we live and our values and, you know, just the realities of growing up as a Native person and raising your family as a Native person. This is a very big deal.
Tlingit and Haida President Richard Peterson praised Haaland for her commitment to tribal sovereignty. He hopes she'll be working on allowing Alaska tribes to exercise the same kind of powers that lower 48 tribes have.
She stands for the things that we stand for, and we've established a really good working relationship with her and feel very confident that she's going to carry out the needs of our tribes here in Alaska.
Senator Lisa Murkowski serves on the committee that decides whether the nomination advances to the full Senate. Haaland is at odds with Murkowski on at least one major issue, drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Haaland demonstrated against it in 2018, but her opening statement to the committee suggests a softer line. Haaland says fossil fuels will continue to play a major role and that oil and gas revenues fund critical services. One of the last remaining participants in the drafting of Alaska's state constitution, Katie Hurley, died Sunday in Portland, Oregon at the age of 99, according to her family. Hurley was the longtime secretary of the Alaska Territorial Governor Ernest Greening, Secretary of State and Chief Clerk of the Alaska Constitutional Convention. Here's Hurley from the 360 North series, Alaska Statehood Pioneers, talking about the smoky, contentious, and emotional state the Constitutional Convention in Fairbanks was in 1955 and 56.
There were some real healthy debates, and it was good to see, and good that it was, because the results were much more effective because they had debated them so heartily. Just the other day, I said it was the biggest thrill of my life, when looking back, to have had that opportunity to be there in that capacity. I felt that I had witnessed statesmanship that I've never seen since.
Hurley went on to become the first woman in Alaska to win a statewide election, having won the Democratic primary for lieutenant governor in 1978. She was elected state representative for Mattsu House District 16A in 1984 and served to 1987. Hurley also served on the Alaska Judicial Council, the Matanuska Electric Association Board, and chaired the Alaska Commission for Human Rights, the State Personnel Board, and the Matanuska Telephone Association Board. In January of 2020, Hurley's daughters created a GoFundMe campaign to help raise funds to pay for her long-term care in Portland. They announced Hurley's death on the page and said that because Oregon's COVID-19 restrictions had recently relaxed, they had spent much of Hurley's final days together, listening to music, holding hands, and singing to her. Experts will talk about the economics of livestock production and other agricultural issues on Saturday during the 49th annual Delta Farm Forum. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, this year's forum will take place online.
UAF Cooperative Extension Service agricultural agent Phil Caspari says it took a while before he and other organizers of this year's Farm Forum reluctantly decided to hold this year's event online. He says they hesitated because so much of what goes on during the event is the kind of information exchange that farmers prefer, and that is talking face-to-face.
It's a very social event, and folks can enjoy that time spent just visiting, catching up.
Caspari says he hopes conducting this year's forum on the Zoom platform may actually help boost interest in the event among out-of-town folks who might not want to spend their Saturday driving to Delta Junction and back. He says depending on the level of online interest in this year's forum, organizers may in the future routinely feature remotely webcast presentations.
We hadn't ever really utilized distance delivery in the farm forum, but I can see from here on out, it'll be an opportunity to tap into agricultural expertise elsewhere.
This year's online forum will feature the usual assortment of presentations on Alaska agriculture. Caspari says highlights include a talk on the economics of producing livestock profitably, to be given by Jenny Bierman, an agriculture and business management specialist with Colorado State University's Extension Service.
Well, it's probably going to be as much for those folks that are considering getting into livestock, can they economically pursue this venture?
Another presentation on a veterinary service that makes house calls for large animal health issues will be given by Annette Yanis, a graduate of the veterinary medicine program jointly operated by the University of Alaska Fairbanks and Colorado State.
The livestock industry locally is growing, and we recognize the need for more workshops on various aspects of livestock production.
The Farm Forum will be held from 9 a.m. to noon Saturday. It's being organized and sponsored by UAF's Cooperative Extension Service, along with the Salcha Delta Soil Conservation Service and Partners for Progress in Delta, a local nonprofit job training program. You can find out more about how to register to watch the forum on Zoom and other information about it by going to the online version of this story on KUAC's news page at fm.kuac.org. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
An Alaska Native corporation has missed a key deadline to get approval to search for oil in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Alaska Public Media's Tegan Hanlon reports that effectively kills the corporation's proposed work in the refuge this winter.
Before it could start on what's known as a seismic survey, the Koktovik Inupiat Corporation had to make three flights to search for polar bear dens in part of the refuge, according to the Department of Interior. But the corporation did not do the work before a deadline of February 13th, the department said. It's unclear why. An official with KIC did not immediately return requests for comment. KIC is the corporation for the village of Koktovik, the only community within the refuge's boundaries, and a place where many Inupiat leaders support oil development. The missed deadline is the latest big setback for drilling proponents who have long wanted to see oil pumped out of the coastal plain. Another came last month when the first ever lease sale for the refuge, held under then-President Donald Trump, attracted very little interest. KIC was proposing to bring heavy trucks onto the coastal plain to search for pockets of oil on part of the land. Environmental groups are celebrating the news that the plan has hit a major roadblock. They had raised concerns about it permanently damaging the tundra and harming wildlife. Any future proposals for seismic work will likely face steeper hurdles under President Joe Biden, who opposes oil development in the refuge. In Anchorage, I'm Tegan Hanlon.
You may not have heard much about the southeast Alaska fishing town of Pelican over the past year, or the indigenous Aleutian Island village of Atka. Those places have stayed out of the news because they're some of the few Alaska communities that have made it through the whole pandemic so far without a single confirmed case of COVID-19. And as Nat Herz with Alaska Public Media reports, some of those communities have vaccinated enough people to be close to reaching herd immunity.
If you fly into the Bering Sea Island village of St. Paul right now, a van will meet you at the airport, says Amos Filmanoff, president of the island's tribal government.
And the driver's all decked out in, a white suit, mask, gloves, the whole nine yards, and he delivers you back to whatever house or facility you're going to be locked down in for 2 weeks.
To put it another way, the island is not messing around with COVID-19. At one point, Filimonov says a charter plane full of seafood processing workers arrived unannounced. They were delivered to their boat on the back of a flatbed truck. While some residents of road system communities have mounted angry resistance to local health mandates, Filimonov says that's not happening in St. Paul.
I haven't had anybody calling me up, saying that this is too restrictive or this is BS or anything like that. It's just, people have been complying.
With 500 residents, St. Paul is one of Alaska's largest communities with zero confirmed coronavirus cases since the start of the pandemic. And roughly half of its adult population has been vaccinated. But it's not the only place to record such impressive numbers.
Everybody claims that it's so hard to get in and out of here. I say, that's perfect. There is no better time to be stranded in what people call the middle of nowhere, because I call it heaven.
Walt Weller is mayor of the tiny and famously remote southeast Alaska fishing town of Pelican, which is more than half vaccinated and has also seen zero confirmed cases among its 75 winter residents. For years, Pelican's leaders have objected to cuts to state-sponsored ferry service, but Weller acknowledges that a months-long gap in visits last year probably helped keep the virus out. He says the island town has taken COVID-19 seriously, closing some buildings and encouraging hand washing and mask wearing, but he attributes most of Pelican's success to its isolation. Alaska has at least 10 communities that have made it through a full year of COVID with no cases, and there are likely more, as the state health department won't release data about villages with fewer than 1,000 people, citing privacy considerations. Many of the communities like Pelican and St. Paul are on islands or otherwise hard to get to, and many have also adopted strict travel and other health mandates. Dr. Ann Zink, Alaska's chief medical officer, says she thinks there's also a degree of luck involved.
But we also know that mitigation strategies work, and it's been pretty amazing to see some of these smaller communities work incredibly close together and collaboratively to be able to keep COVID out of their communities and what that does to protect elders and to protect others.
Zink says she's always worried about declaring victory too early, but she acknowledges that some of the communities with no COVID cases might actually be nearing that point, as vaccination rates in certain places have hit as high as 90% of adults. On St. Paul, Filimonov, the tribal president, says residents aren't letting their guard down. He says discussions are starting about the summertime and whether it will be safe for tourists to visit, maybe in a closed bubble. But in the meantime, there's no escaping the need for hand sanitizer.
I mean, I've never seen so many damn dispensers for hand wash in my life, but they're everywhere. And, you know, it's learning to live the new normal. And well, I hope that someday soon this thing is just like the flu.
For now, St. Paul residents are sticking to social distancing and wearing masks in public buildings, too, Filimonov says. In Anchorage, I'm Nat Herz.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. More unknowns will be making decisions on fishing issues. More after this.
The Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute works to raise the value of our seafood harvest for the benefit of all Alaskans. Learn more at alaskaseafood.org.
Another of Governor Dunleavy's appointments has raised eyebrows among fishery stakeholders. Melvin Smith, an Anchorage real estate executive, will take a lead at the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, which regulates fishing permits and vessel licenses in Alaska's fisheries. The job comes with a six-figure salary. Smith's appointment was not announced nor advertised. Coast Alaska reports that Smith's name surfaced when it was sent to the state Senate for consideration by lawmakers. The commission's next big task is to determine the right number of permits in various limited entry fisheries, a number originally based on historical participation, which may not be the optimum number for a fishery. Also last week, a judge ruled that Governor Dunleavy did not have the power to extend board and commission appointments late last year after the legislature was unable to meet to confirm them due to the COVID pandemic. That includes his controversial Board of Fish appointments of Pebble Mine Regional Affairs Director Abe Williams of Anchorage and unknown sport fish enthusiast Mackenzie Mitchell of Fairbanks, who has no commercial fisheries experience. The Alaska legislature sued Dunleavy over his allowing them and dozens of appointees to continue serving without confirmation as required by law. The judge's decision doesn't affect whether they can serve until they are confirmed. That's a big concern for House Speaker Louise Stutes of Kodiak.
Currently, we have four sitting members, new members, and one old member that have not been confirmed, and some of them just don't have the experience at this point, and they have the opportunity to make monumental decisions affecting people's livelihood.
Find links at alaskafishradio.com. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger. For Tuesday, it is the 23rd day of February, the year 2021. The sun rose today at 8:19. It won't set again until 6:29 p.m., giving us 10 hours and 10 minutes of precious daylight. That is a gain of 4 minutes and 56 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record high was 54, set in 1936, and our record low was -4, set in 1975. Currently 31 degrees here in Kodiak, under mostly cloudy skies, and we're looking for rain tonight, mainly after 10 p.m. The rain could be heavy at times tonight, so that's going to be interesting on all the frozen white stuff we have everywhere. Low of about 33 tonight, south winds to 15 miles per hour, becoming east after midnight. Winds could gust as high as 20. Your chance of precipitation tonight is 100%. New precipitation amounts to maybe half or three quarters of an inch overnight. Rain tomorrow, too, will start mixing with snow after 7 a.m., then gradually ending. The rain could be heavy at times tomorrow as well, with a high near 39 tomorrow. North wind to 20 miles per hour. Could turn to the northwest and go to 30 miles per hour tomorrow afternoon and gust as high as 40 miles per hour tomorrow afternoon. Your chance of precipitation tomorrow, 100%. Mostly cloudy skies tomorrow night with a low around 32. West winds gusting to 30, should decrease to 20 overnight. Could gust as high as 40 tomorrow night, though. Looking at our local district tides, we have a low tide coming up here on the east side at 6:02 this evening of 0.41 feet, followed by a high tide at 12:44 a.m. of 6.3 feet. Our next low tide tomorrow morning will be at 5:30, and that will be a 3.53 foot tide. And our high tide on the east side at nearly noon will be 11:38 a.m. of 8.76 feet. Over on the west side, these are Euganic Pass tides. You have a low tide coming up at 6:28 this evening. That will be a 1.24 foot tide, followed by a high tide at 12:55 a.m. of 12.23 feet. Your low tide for tomorrow morning will be at 6:30 a.m. and be 4.86 feet. And your high tide for tomorrow afternoon will be at 12:17 p.m. on the west side and 13.75 feet. Mariners, here's your synopsis for the North Gulf Coast, including Kodiak Island waters and Cook Inlet. A trough over the North Gulf Coast will remain stationary before dissipating this afternoon. A front will enter the Western Gulf Tuesday morning and move to the Northern Gulf by Tuesday evening. A 996 millibar low, 230 nautical miles south of Kodiak City, on Wednesday morning will move to 180 nautical miles southeast of Middleton Island and go to 978 millibars by Wednesday afternoon. Result of all that, we are looking at a gale warning for Wednesday for Kodiak's east side offshore, Marmot Island to Sitkanak. Southwest winds to 20 knots and seas to 9 feet right now. Southeast 20, becoming east 30 after midnight tonight, seas to 8 feet. For tomorrow on the east side, look for west winds to 35 knots, increasing to 45 knots tomorrow afternoon north of Dangerous Cape. Northeast 30 knots, becoming northwest in the afternoon. Seas to 13 feet tomorrow. For Wednesday night, look for west winds to 35 knots and seas to 14 feet. Over in the Shelikof on Kodiak's west side, small craft advisory for Wednesday. Southwest 20 right now and seas to 5 feet with freezing spray in the Shelikof right now. For tonight, southeast 20 will become northeast after midnight and seas to 5 feet. For tomorrow in the Shelikof, northeast 20 becoming west 30 tomorrow afternoon. Seas 5 feet building to 8 feet tomorrow afternoon. And for Wednesday night, southwest 35, seas to 12 feet in the Shelikof. Looking at inside waters, Chiniac and Marmot Bays. Chiniac Bay, small craft advisory for Wednesday. Variable 10 right now and seas to 2 feet. For tomorrow, northeast 15 will become northwest 25 tomorrow afternoon, seas to 4 feet. For Marmot Bay, variable 10 now, seas will become south 15 this afternoon, seas to 3 feet. For tomorrow, northeast 20 becoming northwest after midnight, seas to 6 feet, should subside to 3 feet tomorrow afternoon in Marmot Bay. Kodiak City Council will hold a work session tonight. The meeting will begin at 7:30 p.m., be held virtually, and there is no in-person attendance for this meeting. Public members are encouraged to tune in here on KMXT at 100.1 FM, and if you'd like to watch and listen in online, there is a link at the City of Kodiak website where you can also find meeting packets. If you wish to request printed materials or have questions, contact the city clerk at 486-8636. The Kodiak City Council will be holding its regular council meeting on Thursday. The meeting will begin at 7:30 p.m. and also be held virtually. Once again, go to the City of Kodiak website for meeting packets and for the link to watch and listen. And it will be tune into KMXT right here on 100.1 FM, 7:30 Thursday night, to listen in yourself. Again, for questions, contact the clerk at 486-8636. The Emergency Operations Center has reported one new case for today. That case was tested on the 20th and is travel-related. That makes 6 cases classified as active locally right now. Your total hospitalizations for the Kodiak area for the pandemic is 42, and there are no active cases currently hospitalized in Kodiak. Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. is the next library trivia game. The Zoom link is on the library's website and Facebook page, which is a great place to visit. If you have questions or need help, call Lori at 486-8666.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 12:20. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.